Okay. Well, good morning, everyone, and welcome to the monthly meeting of the District of Columbia Board of Ethics and Government Accountability. Today is June 9th, 2016. It is 11 a.m., and we are located in room 540 South at 1 Judiciary Square here in Washington, D.C. I'm Robert Spagnoletti, Chair of the Board, and with me today are the full complement of board members, Deborah Latham and Carol Schwartz. We will note, just for the record, that this is Ms. Latham's last board meeting with us. We'll have more about that later. But we are here pursuant, again, to our requirement that we have our monthly meeting. A notice was posted and an agenda was posted consistent with the Open Meetings Act, along with an agenda for today's meeting. Do we have any changes, modifications to the agenda, Ms. Latham?
No, it's fine. Thank you.
Okay, so by consensus, we'll go ahead and adopt the agenda. And with that, item number four, the report from the Director of Open Government, Ms. Hughes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Office of Open Government has conducted two Open Meetings Act ethics combined trainings with MOTA and one combined OMA ethics training with the D.C. Housing Authority Board. We conducted that training yesterday, and the training was a follow-up to the advisory opinion issued by the Office of Open Government concerning the board's failure to comply with the Open Meetings Act, and that advisory opinion was issued in April. Open Meetings Act enforcement and tracking, now that the central calendar is completely migrated to the OOG website, along with a complete list of public bodies, we are now turning our attention to enforcement tracking. Mr. Barton has an update for the board and can provide you with the findings so far.
Okay. Good morning. Tracking the public body subject to the OMA revealed 22 instances of public body violations, 11 instances of public bodies having improperly met or published advance notice to meet in improper closed executive sessions, 7 instances of missing meeting minutes, public notices, agendas, or combinations thereof, and 4 instances of improper citations for holding public meetings. The director's plan of corrective actions is to first telephone each non-complying public body to resolve the issue, to be then followed by an email and, if necessary, a letter. Each contact will remind the public body that the OOG is here to assist them with complying with the OMA.
Okay. Did you notice a pattern of where, which agencies or which public bodies they were? I know we had talked, for example, at one point about all some of the ones that fall within the Department of Health. Do you see, is there a pattern, or is there, are they all over the place?
They're pretty much all over the place.
All right. To be honest with you, given the number of boards and commissions we have in public bodies, the fact that it's, you know, it's only a 2-digit number, not a 3-digit number, is...
That's a very good sign.
It is a good sign.
Now, the only thing that I will say that's a bit problematic, but I'm going to proceed with the soft touches first, is the Cross-Sector Collaboration Task Force. As this board might recall, I issued an advisory opinion quite a few months ago informing that body that they are considered public bodies, that it is considered a public body under the Open Meetings Act, given the scope of its work and the nature of the recommendations that will be made to the mayor. Mr. Barton has found that cross-sector collaboration task force is not complying with the Open Meetings Act. It's conducting meetings with failing to properly notice the public with a draft agenda. And there are also at least one meeting date that I noticed that there's a date that appears. There's a meeting that occurred, but it doesn't appear as part of their yearly calendar meeting dates. So we've got some work to do with that respective public body.
Okay.
Open Meetings Act and FOIA advice. Since the last board meeting, the Office of Open Government has fielded 18 requests for advice. The inquiries are coming from both agencies and members of the public. Public outreach. Mayor Bowser has reinstituted the Open Government Advisory Group. The group is made up of government officials and private sector members and is chaired by Jennifer Reed, who is in the Office of the City Administrator. The bylaws adopted by the last iteration of that group established the director of the OOG as co-chair. We meet for the first time this evening, and it's my assumption that the chair of the group will then provide us with some direction on how she'd like to proceed.
Okay.
More extensive public outreach is one of the promised goals for OOG for fiscal year 17. I sent emails just last week to all constituent services directors of council members and to all ANCs offering the OOG as a resource for both FOIA and the Open Meetings Act. I received a reply right away from an ANC, but no response otherwise. Additionally, I will begin serving a 3-year term on the D.C. Affairs section of the D.C. Bar today.
Congratulations.
Thank you, and I hope to include local FOIA and open records laws as part of the CLE training. Also, I have been asked to return as a presenter with the White House Young African Leadership Initiative. Instead of a 1-hour session, I will conduct a 3-hour session on government transparency and strategic communication. That session will occur at Howard University in July.
That's great.
And finally, the Office of Open Government got a small press hit a couple of weeks ago as part of an op-ed in State Scoop. It's an online news publication. That's a misnomer, right? Online news publication. I was included with a listing of leaders from across the country who are working at the national level to increase government transparency through the use of technology. So it was a nice mention.
That's great.
And that concludes the update. Thank you.
But I have an update based on some email exchanges that we all had concerning the mayor's proposed establishment of a position within the general counsel's office, that is the mayor's general counsel dealing with open government. And the mayor had sent out an announcement, I guess a press release, that this office was going to be established or this person was going to be established and put within the Office of General Counsel. There was some concern raised by members of the open government community and Ms. Hughes as well about the description of that job and the fact that it sounded suspiciously like Ms. Hughes' job and what it meant for the independence of the Office of Open Government and its future. So the email exchanges prompted what then turned out to be a phone conversation with Ms. Cavendish, the mayor's general counsel, where she gave me an explanation that this was not meant in any way to supplant, but rather to supplement the efforts of open government transparency and to have an executive counterpart, if you will, on issues regarding FOIA and open data, to enable the agencies themselves to have a resource within the executive branch to help coordinate this, to provide them advice and guidance within the executive itself. They saw that as helping the Office of Open Government to fulfill its mission. I carried that message back to Ms. Hughes, prompted more discussion between us, and then I eventually decided that it made sense to go to the mayor herself. So I was fortunate enough to ask for and got a meeting with the mayor and Ms. Cavendish, and we sat down and had a very frank conversation about it, and they expressed a little bit of surprise that we didn't think this was one of the, carrying the torch forward, that is, taking everything that Ms. Hughes has done. They were very complimentary, by the way, about the progress that has been made by the Office of Open Government, and they acknowledged the fact that many of the things that happened at the end of the Gray administration, the beginning of the Bowser administration, were things that were as a result of fires being lit by Ms. Hughes. So they were very good, very complimentary on that score. They saw this as being sort of an analog to the agency ethics officers that are on the agencies that provide sort of on-the-ground ethics advice. They'd be doing the same kind of thing with FOIA and open data. And because there is so much that needs to be done with getting the agencies compliant with FOIA and also getting them to understand the importance and the mechanics of the open data system, that they needed someone in the mayor's general counsel's office to be their point person who could work directly with the agencies. We had a very frank conversation about the need to communicate all of this before public announcements are made because it leads to lots of questions and uncertainty. They expressed the desire and need to be working with Ms. Hughes and the Office of Open Government throughout this. They value the independence of the office. They understand that they can be held accountable that way through an independent voice. They told me that they were going to make Ms. Hughes part of the leadership of the advisory council, which they clearly have, and they encouraged her to attend the cabinet meetings to be front and center, along with the other executive officers and the cabinet members of the executive. And it seemed as if they were very committed to the same kinds of transparency efforts that Ms. Hughes has been talking about for some time. and that they were not looking to undermine her role as an independent entity. I explained to them the nature of the board and our role and our relationship with Ms. Hughes, because they seemed to be under the impression that the board and the Office of Open Government had the same relationship as the board and the Office of Government Ethics, which is sort of an internal name for the director and his group of folks that work for him. And we explained, no, the Office of Open Government is independent, put underneath the board, but that Ms. Hughes, as the director, is her own person. We are here to support and to help, and she reports information to us, but does not report to us in that way. And so that led to just a discussion about the need to directly communicate with Ms. Hughes on these issues and to coordinate better. And Ms. Cavendish, in particular, expressed a great willingness to do so. So we approach this optimistically, at least I do, and hopefully that as they move forward, I guess we'll know a little bit more after tonight, and you have your first meeting, about what direction the executive is going with this. I will say that they were very candid about the executive's need to step up their game when it comes to making data available in, you know, all the formats that it's supposed to be accessible, and as well as being more FOIA compliant, and the link between this, having better open data will reduce the pressure on FOIA, because then if the stuff is out there already, you don't need to be having FOIA requests all the time. So they also emphasized that they've been placed at a bit of a disadvantage in managing the day-to-day legal issues that come up with things like HIPAA and Privacy Act and the rest, with the separation of the Office of the Attorney General and its independence from the Executive Office of the Mayor, because now everything falls on the Mayor's General Counsel as opposed to the Attorney General. Not that they don't and couldn't ask him for advice, but obviously he's now an independent entity and they feel that they really want to have some measure of their own view of things within the executive. And so that's why this position sits in the general counsel's office, will be sort of the executive analog to Ms. Hughes, and they expect to have regular ongoing communication. That's what she reported to me, and I, of course, reported that back to Ms. Hughes after having that meeting. But I think that a couple of things that were notable about this is, one, is that they seemed genuinely surprised that there were people in the community worried about this, as opposed to cheering it on as evidence of their commitment to open government and transparency and to all the things that Ms. Hughes has been talking about. Secondly, that they value what happens with the Office of Open Government, even when they don't always agree what's going on with the executive. And I think we may have mentioned along the way the fact that you testified in opposition to the mayor's FOIA treatment of the body-worn camera footage. And the third thing I think that is, I said two, but there are really three good indicators, is that, I mean, I spoke with you like on a Tuesday, and I met with the mayor on a Wednesday. Mm-hmm. So she cares about it enough to make time in her schedule to meet with me to discuss it. So I do think that speaks to their commitment to the issue. Now, time will tell, right? Now, time will tell. But I am glad, at least, that they are talking, that you're being included, at least at these early stages, and we'll see how it plays out.
Right. Mr. Chairman?
Yes, ma'am.
As someone who's kind of involved with the emails, I'm glad that it turned out to be what we hoped it would be, and I like your term, and that is supplementing, not supplanting. And I think that it initially that because if you looked at the description, it sounded more like an office than an officer. And that, you know, since it was then described as someone who was going to be working in the legal counsel's office of the mayor's office, I mean, then, and it is supplemental, I think it can be helpful, because, you know, we see that as we try to deal with these open government issues that sometimes there's been some roadblocks and it's been difficult. And if you've got a counterpart over in the mayor's office that you can say, here, red light. I mean, here's a problem. Here's a problem area. And that person can go make sure it's taken care of. That should be helpful to your job, Ms. Hughes, instead of harmful. And I think that's a good thing. I also, though, do hope that, as I look at one of the things as I came on board, and I haven't been here but a few months, is when I see the kind of amazing things that this BEGA does with the staff it has, I'm really impressed, because government staffs are not usually given such responsibility with such small staffs,
right.
And I've been really impressed, Ms. Hughes, with what you've been able to do with a couple of people and what BEGA, the ethics part has been able to do with hardly a big staff. And one of the things that concerned me when I read the press release was, oh dear, here comes not just an officer, but an office. And here comes all this, money maybe going to people in that office. While we're sitting here just barely getting by with the few people we've got with huge responsibilities. And I've never been about bureaucracy. Anybody that ever watched me in my elected position, it was like lean and mean operations. But when you look at our responsibilities and you look at the number of staff people, it's still very lean and mean and maybe too lean. And so I didn't want to have to get in a competition either for the few resources that are available in these kind of areas where we would be, like begging and the others would be just getting. And so that was a little worry of mine as well. But once it was explained that this is a position, now of course this position probably is going to have some secretarial administrative type of person. But, I think we need to also just, kind of keep an eye out that it not be becoming an expensive office to run, and therefore maybe taking away our ability to get the kind of staff we need. Oh, we're already doing this in the area of open government. We're already doing this in the area of ethics. And then here we are, a board assigned real responsibility. In fact, I read a newspaper article today, and this preceded me, so I can't take credit. Just you and Deborah can take credit for this. And that is, as they were talking about the at-large race, two things had come down on two of the candidates, and both of them BEGA had been responsible for. Now, I had been there for one of them. Actually, I was there for one out of the two, not the first one. But so, I mean, we've got a lot of responsibility, and I think we take it very seriously, but we've got to have the people to be able to do the kind of job we need to do. So that was my one concern as well. And hopefully that one, won't become a big deal. But I'm certainly pleased with you, Mr. Chairman, for recognizing the validity of the concerns that were raised and jumping on it and taking care of it and coming back and explaining it to us. And it was very, very helpful in the process. And thank you.
Brief comment. First, Tracy, I have been amazingly impressed with what you are able to do with so little. I mean, I'm impressed by your dedication and your insights and, essentially, I mean, you are the office with your new assistant, and you do quite a bit. But I also think, from a larger perspective, I think that it's important to have communication. And so my concern with the mayor's office was the lack of communication, the lack of, coming and talking to you and asking what you need and how we can work together and how should this new position be established. And I understand that it's with the executive's prerogative, to do as the executive pleases, but I think for good government, I think communication is essential. And that is not a criticism of you. That is, I'm feeling free to make a criticism of the executive office in that regard. Also, there's a question, when I sit back as, a resident of the District of Columbia and I see the Office of Open Government, and then I see a new position, and I'm saying, well, why do you need a new position? You're always talking about your budgetary concerns, and yet you seem to be duplicating offices. We have an attorney general. You have to have your own general counsel. These are not criticisms intended for you. This is like my, you know, my last stand. And so I would hope that there would be more communication between the executive branch and us. That's really and then the final thing that I kind of learned in my career, I remember a senior executive when I was in the law department of a company in Chicago saying to me, never cede jurisdiction, never cede jurisdiction, because once you cede it, you never get it back. Okay? I used to be a litigator. That's sort of what I passed along.
Right. Well, thank you. I will say that the lesson in all this for me is that because the office has been in a position of just constantly playing catch up with not having enough resources under it to really fully function and to function well, I've been very much in the trenches and my head has been down and I've just been doing the work. So I haven't been able to devote as much time as I would like to diplomatic efforts. I thought that we were doing a better job at that than apparently what this reveals. So the lesson in it for me is that I've got to make more of a concerted effort to do better in that regard. And so that's why I've asked Mr. Barton to proceed with the enforcement efforts and just doing these couple of soft touches first, because perception is 9/10 of reality. It doesn't really matter much. Doesn't matter much what this office is actually doing. What matters to the executive is what they perceive. So if they see me playing nicer in the sandbox, I'll fall over myself even more. Then okay, but you know, we'll take it from here. We're starting with a clean slate, and I'm hopeful that whoever this new person is going to be, that we can establish a very productive and collaborative relationship, so that we're not stepping on each other's toes, and we can support one another.
And plus, you have a big head start on a lot of the technical stuff that this person, I'm guessing, won't know, because you have a relationship with Octo and everybody else. So you could leverage those relationships and resources in a way that might help build that relationship.
Correct. And Ms. Cavendish was not aware that I had already done the research and drafted a template data sharing agreement for every agency to use, and to massage it for internal use for data sharing, and then also for sharing data with external entities. So we'll see.
Fingers crossed.
Yes.
All right. Thank you. So item 5, report from the Director of Government Ethics, Mr. Sobin.
Morning, board members. As a preliminary matter, it gives me great pleasure to formally introduce Mr. Rudy Chanoun, BEGA's newest attorney advisor. Mr. Chanoun comes to us from the civil litigation firm McCarthy Wilson, where he served as a litigation associate. Mr. Chanoun did his undergraduate work at Dartmouth and graduated law school from William & Mary. Following graduation, Mr. Chanoun served as a public interest law fellow for the Office of the Attorney General, before then accepting a judicial clerkship with the Honorable Eric M. Johnson in the Montgomery County Circuit Court. Last year, Mr. Chanoun was named one of the 2015 super lawyers rising stars in both Maryland and the district. Mr. Chanoun will assume the Hatch Act duties of the office in addition to the regular responsibilities of a BEGA attorney. We are very pleased to have Mr. Chanoun on board with us.
Well, welcome.
You'll hear from him shortly on a couple of matters. We've already got him elbow deep.
Welcome.
Okay, item A, investigations. We opened 11 this month, and that was up one from last month where we had opened 10. We closed 9, which is way up from last month where we had closed 0. And so we're getting closer to my comfort level with investigations currently open at 16, down from 20 the previous month. We only had one case this month that we received that had to be stayed and is currently inactive. So that brings us to 17 currently inactive or stayed cases. Publication and reporting obligations, FDS noncompliance. We are in substantial compliance with our reporting obligations. By statute, we are required to publish in the D.C. Register each year those employees who are public financial disclosure statement filers, those who should have filed but did not, and those who received extensions. Those lists will appear in tomorrow's D.C. Register on time, with the exception of advisory neighborhood commissioners. Because of a glitch in our e-filing system, those individuals did not make it onto the overall lists that were submitted to ODAI by the deadline on Tuesday. The non-compliant ANC commissioners will appear in next week's D.C. Register. This is yet another example of a problem that underscores the need to proceed post-haste with our planned overhaul of the e-filing systems, the first phase of which should be underway before the end of the fiscal year. The upside to this is that we have additional time now to contact these ANC non-filers and get them filed so that their names do not have to appear on the non-filer list at all. We have hired a temp to help facilitate that process.
How many folks are we talking about here, roughly?
Filers or non-filers?
Non-filers.
ANC.
Non-filers.
About 113.
Wow. Which is a lot when we have 300 ANCs.
Yeah.
That's
a lot. So we're trying everything to
it's
get
like
them to file.
Close to a quarter.
And I do want to, I'll just say publicly, the office has gone above and beyond to try to get folks to file so that they, because the goal here, of course, is to get the stuff filed, not to find people. I mean, obviously you can do it when they're a day late, but it strikes me as being very, you guys are very proactive and thoughtful in how you approach this, and now you've got this little bit of extra time to get these ANCs on board. Hopefully they'll take advantage of it. So.
Item C, trainings and outreach. I'm also very pleased to announce that BEGA attorney Ashley Cooks has agreed to take over as the training coordinator position for the office, a position left vacant following the departure of Mr. Burns. Ms. Cooks has already restarted the BEGA newsletter and will continue our plans to automate some of the training functions and increase access to training materials. She's already looking to redesign a portion of the ethics training on the website. I'm grateful that Ms. Cooks has agreed to lend her talents to this task, in addition to keeping up with her regular responsibilities as a BEGA attorney advisor.
Great.
Thank you, Ashley. Ms. Cooks is also organizing this year's Best Practices Symposium at the UDC David A. Clark School of Law. In addition to the regular evening, two-hour-long panel discussions that we've had in the past, we will be expanding the program to an entire day of ethics training and open government FOIA training classes for interested government employees, in conjunction with the Director of Open Government. Much like the federal government, which holds an ethics summit each year, this will give employees the opportunity to select one or more of our specialized trainings throughout the day.
That's great. And maybe, and I'm sure you're already doing this, but with the Office of the Attorney General, their lawyers have a training requirement, and it would be a great offer for them to, because they have, they've got annual CLE requirement with as OAG attorneys, to get, maybe that could be part of what they're doing.
So. Do we have a date? Is it scheduled?
We don't have a date yet. Ms. Cooks is working on it.
Okay, but you'll let us know?
It'll be sometime in October, usually mid-October.
Okay,
to give
Thank
Mr.
You.
Grimaldi enough time to get to the best practices report after that.
Right. And on a related note, mind the board, last year. Thank you.
No, that's all right. Leave it there.
Board decided to look into the subject of BEGA's role in contracting and procurement. And it was last week, I believe, Mr. Sobin, Mr. Flowers, and myself met with a delegation from OCP. Somebody there had reached out to us on the subject of contractors, basically doing the same work as government employees, but operating under a completely different set of rules. So it was a good meeting. They are actually going to send to us a draft contract clause to put in, I think, a test sample. I used to call them the ITSA folks. Now they're what? Pass-through? Or what's their new buzzword? Whatever. But, the personal service type. Be a contract clause, which will, make them agree to abide by our jurisdiction.
And
so it was a good start.
That's great. We've been talking about this now for some time. So that does seem like a great step forward.
Yeah.
That's great.
If I can add, and not that it has to stop the train, but the Office of Open Government is participating in the National Freedom of Information Conference, National Conference here in D.C., Columbus Day weekend. So it will be that Thursday and Friday of that week leading up to Columbus Day. So,
not that week?
We'll be out of pocket. Yeah.
The entire week?
Not the entire week. I'm just that Thursday and Friday. Yes.
Mm-hmm. I think we try to have them on Tuesdays anyway,
yeah,
don't we?
We have been, yeah. I think Tuesdays.
Okay.
Which is fine. I mean, we can, it's far enough in advance we can work out the dates. That's great.
All right. Trainings. we've been doing so much training for others, we've hardly had any training for ourselves. Mr. Chanoon and Ms. Cooks did a webinar entitled Write Sound Briefs, the Winning Brief by Brian Garner. Conducted by staff, we did a huge number, 14, which was almost every day of the, with the exception of, I guess, 6 days during the course of the month. We did two regular 2-hour monthly ethics trainings, 2 new employee orientations, 3 Hatch Act trainings, 2 offered to all district employees, and 1 for the Criminal Justice Coordinating Council, 2 trainings for the State Board of Education, 1 for the D.C. Housing Authority Board of Directors, 2 for third-party contractors at the Department of Consumer and Regulatory Affairs, and 3 other general boards and commissions trainings conducted along, as Ms. Hughes said, with the Office of Open Government. We also conducted 2 additional full ethics trainings for the Child and Family Services Agency, which raised more questions for us than it answered, I think. I can go into that later. And for accepted service employees within the Executive Office of the Mayor. On Friday, Mr. Flowers and I will be conducting a targeted ethics training for employees of the Office of the City Administrator. It really has been a busy month of employee training and in some cases even contractor training.
Are you sure you shouldn't want to rethink your volunteering for the training job, Ms. Cook?
I'm also exploring a collaboration with the University of the District of Columbia Law School to mentor law students with respect to legal writing skills. Essentially, some of our attorneys would volunteer their time to serve as writing coaches for law students. The mayor has challenged all agencies to do more in the community, and this initiative, I believe, will not only help produce superior law school graduates, our future applicant pool, but further establish BEGA as one of the district government's elite legal writing groups. Finally, I'd like to mention that we are producing a BEGA training video that will air on the DC Government Television Network. This 4-minute video will feature a professional actor and members of the BEGA staff who will address the most common ethical lapses. In particular, this epidemic, it seems, that we have now of misuse of fleet share vehicles.
I have noticed the uptick.
Mr. Grimaldi will be starring in a scene that gets right at the heart of the misuse of government vehicle.
Are you going for to your equestrian lesson?
Golf.
Golf. Nice.
We intend to use this video at all new employee orientations as well as to start our 2-hour training sessions.
Question there.
Yeah.
Will you include in that post-employment, because we get a bit of that, post-employment obligations?
Gifts, post-employment, misuse of government property, and Hatch Act.
And how about handicap placards? No.
General umbrella.
We want to know that. Okay. I mean, that's like, okay.
Okay. And I'm actually pretty excited about it. The production company is a CBE, so that helps us with our CBE obligation as well. It's a pretty decent company. They're just starting a sitcom, producing a sitcom with Ed Asner.
I saw that article in the paper. Yeah.
So that's this group. So we'll see how it goes. Okay. Advisory opinions and advice. Got a few items here. First, the Mayor's Statehood Initiative. In your Dropbox is an official request for an advisory opinion from the Mayor's Office concerning permissible activities by government employees with respect to the Mayor's Statehood Initiative. The request for the opinion is directed both to us and to the Office of Campaign Finance. That's because our responsibilities in this area are divided. The Office of Campaign Finance has authority to opine on issues related to the use of government resources for campaign-related purposes, while we have authority to interpret the Hatch Act and general standards of conduct concerning misuse of government resources, like employees. We anticipate an opinion by the Office of Campaign Finance and an opinion by us on these discrete areas. Mr. Grimaldi is working on it currently, and we've been asked to do it on an expedited basis, so it's taking priority at this point.
Which makes sense. I've already received a few emails from Shelley Broderick over at UDC, general invitation emails to talk about the constitutional convention and right. meetings and the rest. So I can understand why they want this in an expedited manner.
The memo itself, as you can see in your Dropbox, is very detailed, which we appreciate because they've carved questions out for us to make it easier to answer.
Right. Okay.
The FEMS conflict waiver request for AMR. We talked about this the last couple of times. So they were the last thing that happened on this was that you guys had asked them. We filed our opposition to the waiver request, and you guys asked them for a reply. And they've now since said that they're happy with what they've submitted. There's no need for them to reply, and so whatever you guys decide is fine with them. So it's in the ball's in the board's court.
Yeah. So I guess what I would propose is this: is that we had a fairly lively discussion and took information from them after you submitted your. Because we had just received your written response. And so to the extent that there was information provided at, I know they're not submitting anything written, but instead going to rely on their public comments and explanations for things.
Sure.
I think I'd like to know before making a decision what OG's position is given the additional information they provide, whether it changes or not. It may not change your view, but even if it's just sort of a summary that we stand by this or we've been influenced by this or we see this, that, or the other thing that they've said during our interchange, because if this is going to be the record, I just want to give you the last word, if you will, and then we'll take this up at the July meeting.
If you want something, see, my recollection was that their position was, maybe my staff has a different recollection, but I thought they've pretty much tracked what their written submission was. I don't remember anything different.
To be honest with you, it was so new to us at the moment. I mean, we literally received it an hour before the meeting. Is that I just don't recall sitting here now whether or not the sum total of what they presented and what we talked about. Like, for example, I know we discussed we asked a lot of questions, a lot of factual questions that we did not know we had not known the answers to in advance, and I'm assuming you didn't either, about the number of employees, the scope of the responsibility of the employees, the impact, whether there was an approval process. I remember that, for example, being a factor for us, a question for us about whether or not they had to tell somebody that they were going to be working for AMR. Now, again, it may not impact anything that you have to tell us at the end of the day,
okay.
But I do think that it makes sense, even if it's a two-liner saying we consider everything and we have no difference of opinion,
okay.
And then take it up at the July board meeting.
So we'll go back and we'll re-listen to the to what was said, okay, Brian? And we'll make a decision after.
Because
that.
I'd like to reread all of that stuff as well, just to make sure that I'm clear on kind of where you were, what they said, what I recall from our discussion before making a decision. Because there were a number of pros and cons. And I have to tell you, every day I see an AMR ambulance out there somewhere. I mean, every single day.
Yeah, I walk past GW Hospital on the way home from work, and I only see AMR ambulances in the ambulance bay.
I drop between my office and my home. I kid you not, every day there's an AMR ambulance, every day.
Indeed. Okay.
So, anyway.
So we'll do that.
Okay. No, and I appreciate that because we do rely very much, at least I do, and I know Bob, you're a lawyer, I'm not, very much rely on your opinions on these what could be controversial subjects.
Sure.
And so.
I think we'll call it a supplemental.
Yeah. Yes, no, I'm not looking for anything extensive. All I want to know is was there anything that was said that changes any part of your view one way or the other? And if not, that's fine. But I want to reread it, take into consideration any changes that you think, and then before we start debating it.
And I do like the idea of they're listening to the tape and just kind of talking about it again. And then if you come back with the same opinion, so be it.
Right. Exactly.
I just think.
I have a question.
Yes.
Any concern, like Bob, you were just saying everywhere you go, you see these trucks, I mean, these ER vehicles, the AMR.
Right.
Is there any question that there could be an improper delegation of the city service to a private contractor without going through proper processes and procedures? Say, for example, if they could not provide more than 50% of the ambulance service now from the district, would that have required them a formal bidding process to have that volume. I know that's probably more than procurement here.
Sure.
There's a question I have, and I won't be here for the answer, but is, you know, is this sort of a improper granting of a contract to a contractor without having, you know,
so the, I guess, with my limited knowledge of how the procurement process actually worked here, I guess I could say that that it was closely scrutinized by the media how this whole thing worked, and we have had no reports from anybody either inside or outside of the government that the procurement process was suspect.
I guess that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying if you start up sort of de minimis, hey, we're just letting our force work with these people, work with AMR.
Mm.
And then it just sort of grown and grown by all the emphasis that you see or AMR.
Ryan, you looked at the contract, didn't you? Did you see it? And it's a, the contract itself is kind of open-ended in the sense that they're only supposed to be taking to the hospital people that do not need emergency medical services. So you call up, 911, and one of our ambulances shows up first in every case. And our guys check out the patient, and if our guys determine that the patient is, not in dire need of emergency medical services, but they still need to go to the hospital for some reason, they'll call AMR, and AMR will come and transport that person to the hospital. And our guys are freed up to go to the next emergency call. That was the theory.
What we saw was a letter contract.
Can you with microphone for Brian?
Oh, I'm sorry.
What we saw was a letter contract that had not yet been submitted to the council. So that was, we never saw any contract that had been submitted to the council. That might have some bearing on whether or not this is, something that would require additional scrutiny. Once the council approved it, then you got two branches of government that have approved it. It's always an open constitutional question, but we don't usually decide constitutional issues.
Okay, on to the next item. This is a conflict determination waiver request from the Department of Public Works and DHCD. It's in your inbox. It's a conflict waiver request from the Department of Public Works, or DPW. DPW is seeking a determination as to whether a husband, who we'll call employee A, for privacy purposes, who is an employee of DPW, and a wife, who we'll call employee B, who is an employee of the Department of Housing and Community Development, DHCD, violated the conflict of interest provision regarding an award of a grant administered by DHCD to DPW. If there is a violation, then the DPW seeks a waiver of that conflict. The grant itself is the Community Development Block Grant, or CDBG. I love these acronyms, and the amount of $2.4 million. Now, the grant would be used to clear and clean alleys in Ward 7 and 8. Employees from both agencies, including Employee A and Employee B, participated substantially and personally in the award of the grant. The question is whether the participation of Employee A and Employee B will have a direct and predictable effect on their financial interests, which does not appear to be the case after we reviewed it, for several reasons. First, they are the spouses are statutorily prohibited from receiving bonuses. Second, the effect of their participation in the grant with respect to promotions and the like is too speculative in my view. It is unclear whether a grant award is factored into the recipient spouse's evaluation when there is a personnel evaluation, given the actual number of people involved in the process. And you'd also have to assume that the grant was steered to DPW as opposed to another agency for the purpose of boosting the recipient spouse's annual performance rating, which is also speculative.
Especially since it's DPW that cleans the streets, so that's...
Even then, a positive performance rating may not necessarily result in a promotion. And as a result, we determined that there does not appear to be a conflict of interest that even needs waiving.
Yeah, I have to say, as I was reading it, I was first struck by you know, of course, it's husband and wife, and so you think that your eyebrows go up, right, husband? Then you think, wait a minute, this is two government agencies. This
right.
is money going to fund a program. I mean, every day agencies enter into interagency agreements to transfer funds for particular purposes. I mean, heck, OAG was funded that way primarily in many respects for a long time. And the fact that it's husband and wife, unless, again, there's some unusual payment scheme or kickback scheme that's going on there, it's hard to see how there's any financial conflict of interest at all. And I have to say, as I was halfway through DPW's request thinking, okay, so where exactly is the conflict? I realize, I mean, it is, look, to her credit, she wants to, you know, she's covering her bases, and if the public at large, who maybe not fully understands a lot of this stuff, sees a husband and wife both involved in a exchange,
right.
maybe there's a question, but I have to say, I agree. I don't see how this at all is a financial conflict of interest.
And I'm not even sure the conflict of interest statute was intended.
Designed for interagency yeah. transfers. I agree with it.
So,
is there any way, though, you know, only because I think, as you said, you raise eyebrows when it's husband and wife and it is a contract, and is there any way that, and I also appreciate that the recommendation that you have made, our staff has made, as well as our chair, but is there any way that for things like this that you can ever put them like totally on a back burner? They're not anything we're going to do anything about probably, but that maybe look down the pike to make sure that nobody got an advancement or a raise or something that might in any way be associated. Is that possible to do?
Well, sure. And in fact, this is one of those great cases where we do rely on our agency ethics counselors because, you know, out of an abundance of caution, our agency ethics counselor reported this to us. So, she's
no, and that I appreciate it.
Yeah. So I'm sure we'll hear about it if there's anything that comes.
Okay. Well, I would like, even if we don't hear about it, if we maybe look into it down the pike and just see if everything was just totally as it should be, and we're expecting it to be.
Is there a way to track that, Brian, currently in the pro-law system?
What?
We can certainly
use what?
Use alerts in there.
Maybe next year's performance.
Our general counsel just said it could be calendared.
Reminder to look in.
Reminder to look at 6 months or a year from now or something.
Okay. Can you put that on Outlook?
Yes. What are we looking for? Whether or not they received a promotion?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, one of the spouses just received a promotion. Right. I believe he went from an administrator to a deputy of the agency.
Yes, that's correct.
But
preceding or post?
Well, they haven't gotten it yet. I mean, this is all in the works still, right?
So it was preceding.
It can't have been.
Yeah, so, okay, I'm looking for posts, not preceding.
Oh,
okay?
Preceding. It just happened like 2 months
ago. Yeah.
Okay. I'm not looking for preceding. I'm only looking for posts. So that's a good suggestion about calendaring it. Thank you all.
So we do have a document that we prepared, that I prepared for you on this that has spaces for you to sign at the bottom.
Right.
If you agree with what I'm writing back to the agency, which is that we don't see a conflict of interest.
Right.
Needs waiving.
And I'm comfortable signing as long as we're calendaring it. Okay?
Do we have the document, guys? Okay. All right, we'll have that document for you to sign in just a minute. Okay, ethics legislation, just to the informal advice, just our numbers are this month pretty high, 81. We answered 81 informal advice queries since the last meeting, which was up from 66 the previous month. And of course, this does not include the hundreds and hundreds of advice queries that were answered in connection with lobbyist and FDS filings. Item E, the ethics legislation, comprehensive code of conduct. Review of Bill 21250, the comprehensive code of conduct of the District of Columbia and Bega Amendment Act 2015. As you know, we were carefully looking at it and reviewing it after it's been sitting for a year, and we completed our review of the bill that's sitting in committee. A draft of the memo reflecting the revisions made as a result of the review is put in the Dropbox for today's meeting, so you have it. Unless anyone has suggested changes to the memo, We intend to finalize it and send it to the Judiciary Committee by close of business tomorrow. Mr. Grimaldi and I have been, and I have a meeting scheduled for next Monday with the committee's legal fellow who has been teeing up the bill for the committee's consideration. I'll report what comes of that meeting and any other developments at the next board meeting, but we really, really want to get it out, want it to be voted out of committee before the council's recess this summer.
Sure. And I will say that the thing that struck me most about looking at the proposed changes is how minor they are, which speaks, I think, volumes about how comprehensive the Comprehensive Code of Conduct really is and how thoughtful it was. You guys did the lion's share of the work getting it together, that even a year later it required very little tinkering and it was just, you know, very minor stuff. And that should also give the committee some great comfort that even in the markup process, not a whole lot needs to be done to make it current and bring it up to speed on some of these things. But I commend you guys for taking the time to go through it line by line, comma by comma.
We had the time. We may as well do it because it's just sitting in committee now for a year.
And in this time, I'm hopeful that it will, that they'll do something with it before the summer recess.
Can I ask if we've gotten any word about what the committee is thinking about? I know you say we're hoping, and we've been talking about before they recess in July. Do we have any indication that that's a possibility?
That was my assumption about 3 months ago. We'll find out on Monday when we have the meeting with the council staff.
And the committee staffer has said that was...
It was going to be a priority right after the budget was done, and, of course, now the budget's done.
Okay.
Okay.
I think if you need any help, why don't you holler?
Will do. Thank you for the support. One other item that's in your Dropbox.
So I take it the board has no substantive...
No, not for me.
None here.
Thank you.
So it's good to go then, Jack. We'll get it out.
Yeah.
The other item we put in your Dropbox was the Advisory Neighborhood Commission's Omnibus Amendment Act of 2016. We included this bill because it contains a couple of provisions that might be of interest to OGE and to the Office of Open Government. With respect to OGE, the bill proposes to quantify the definition of nominal refreshments for a public commission meeting, saying that it may now include up to $100 of food and non-alcoholic beverages. The existing language simply permitted them to expend funds on, quote, nominal refreshments at commission meetings. And believe me, having done the ANC opinions for years when I was at the Attorney General's office, that's the number one question I got was, what is a nominal refreshment? So at least there's a definition for it right now, or if it passes. Okay, item F, rulemaking. Changes to the rules. Last month I reported that we had finished our working sessions and are in the process of producing a redline version of proposed rule changes for the board's review. Unfortunately, given the press of other business, we have not made measurable progress on this redline version. We will continue our efforts. On the budget, item G, there are no updates with respect to the budget, except that we expect to spend down both our personal services funds and non-personal service funds almost completely by the end of the year. Item H, staffing. With the addition of Mr. Chanoon, we are fully staffed. Actually, I understand that this is a rarity for any district agency, so I'm glad that we are
fully staffed. Being small helps.
We're over fully staffed. We have a temp upstairs working right now on the FDS stuff. All right, lobbyists and financial disclosure matters. I guess I'll invite Ms. Pat Selt up to address this.
Yes. What would meeting be without waiver requests?
Truly no meeting at all. So there are three of them today. The first is 1488-001, In Re Sturgis Web Services, and that one the director does not oppose. Mr. Sturgis, as was indicated in his waiver request, had a meeting on June 30th, but that meeting was purely informational. It didn't look like any lobbying actually occurred, and so he did not file an activity report until the January one, where he properly disclosed everything he was supposed to disclose, which is why we don't oppose it.
And given the fact that he probably spent more in the value of time by writing that very long letter explaining mm-hmm. that it was a one-day off informational meeting, I would totally vote in favor of the waiver.
Agree.
Is 1506-001 In Re CLH New York Avenue LLC. Similarly, the director does not oppose this waiver either. CLH, Manette Phelps and Phillips, CLH's lobbyist, filed this waiver request on their behalf and indicated that they were trying to file a hard copy. They didn't realize they needed to file electronically. When they did attempt to do so, there was a miscommunication between our office and their office. For that reason, we don't oppose the waiver request.
And
but didn't they pay more to Manette than $300 to write the letter?
I have no doubt that is true as well. So I would, I vote to approve the waiver.
Agreed.
This was the result of a Vega employee that no longer works here, Christina, is that correct?
Yes. Yeah.
I would just note for the record that even with that one request based on the miscommunication, compared to last year's waivers as a result of communication issues, that is nothing compared to last year.
Very much agreed. And then the last one is 1509-001 In Re Crown Castle NG Atlantic LLC. Crown Castle sought a waiver that was in the Dropbox that you've all seen. For the reasons in our opposition, we oppose a full granting of the waiver. We believe that the waiver request should be denied, but we do acknowledge that there are some mitigating factors that could, if the board so chooses, justify a partial reduction of the fine amount. The fine's currently at $300 for failing to file a July 2015 activity report. Crown Castle acknowledges that they were supposed to file one and that it simply fell through the cracks, essentially, at their office.
But
the mitigating factor is that there was nothing to report. Exactly. Nothing to report. And they did properly report for the next reporting period.
In the interest of being sort of consistent with how we handle these things across the board, my recollection, and correct me if I'm wrong, because you'll remember this better than I will, is that last year there were a number of these sort of middling circumstances where there was a reason, not exactly a legal defense, but it was a good enough reason for us to justify a half cut of the fine.
Yes.
And so in the interest of being consistent with those, although I don't feel so strongly about it one way or the other, I will vote to agree with the director's recommendation about cutting it in half.
Wasn't this the one where they had a paper written, they were tracking by paper, and then they were moving to the electronic?
That was the previous one.
Oh, that was Sturgis.
Yep. Or no, CLH.
CLH. Oh,
yeah,
okay.
That was the previous one.
They just didn't do it, but there was no activity.
Right.
Yeah.
And this is their first time.
Yes, this July report was the first time they had filed anything with the district.
And I remember last year we had a bunch of folks who had no activity, and we got into this big brouhaha about whether you have to file when you have no activity. Mm-hmm. We made it very clear, no, the whole purpose is to tell us. How are we supposed to know if you have no activity unless you tell us?
Right.
So that's an important message to get across. And even when you have no activity, you have to file, but it's your first time out, so we'll give you.
Yeah, and I would stress that, you know, you get one free pass. You know.
Yes.
And I felt, reading it, that this was a good compromise, so I agree.
Okay.
Thank you.
Great. But let me be clear. Did we agree that we just partially reduced it
to
150 instead of 300? Oh.
Yes. That was a recommendation, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay. FDS?
I just mentioned FDS quickly. Okay. The financial disclosure filing deadline has passed. All of Vega's public filers in our office filed on time. After the deadline passed, we sent lists of all public non-filers to the ethics counselors to request their help in getting their agency's non-compliant individuals to file. We also sent a noncompliance reminder email to all non-filers on May 27th, 2016, reminding them that they needed to file before June 2nd, or their names would be submitted as non-filers to the DC Register. We have satisfied our statutory publication requirement when it comes to financial disclosures as well. We sent three lists, as we said, to the Office of Documents. I already mentioned this early on. I won't go over it again. We're now going to, though, even now that the lists have been submitted, we're going to continue the process of reaching out to the non-filers via email, U.S. mail, and phone before we institute any fines. We're going to give them another chance to file. Regarding confidential filers, June 1st marked the date all confidential filer review reports were due. These reports are submitted to us by each agency and disclose who of their confidential filers failed to file, if any, and disclose any potential or actual conflicts of interest discovered in the agency's review of their confidential filer submissions. Our auditor, Ms. Alawamne, will now review these reports to determine if any action needs to be taken with respect to the potential conflicts of interest. I will say I got an email, sort of a disturbing email 2 days ago from the director of an agency, and I'm not going to say which at the moment, but they want a meeting with us because they said that on their confidential financial disclosure filer side that they're getting about 50% success in getting their folks to file, and they want to figure out what they're doing wrong. Are they over-designating? Or are they just not doing enough to get their folks to file? So I said I needed a couple days just to get our lists, and then we're going to plan to file or meet with them.
Is this an agency that had trouble with this last year, or is this?
I don't recall.
They may have just greatly increased their. Right. No, it's not an agency that had 50%, you know, failure to file in the past. But
right.
We don't know what the problem.
Okay.
So
well,
we're going to deal with that.
Check into it.
All right. Let me see. Just a quick shout out to the administration. On their side, we were really very successful in working with them to get their folks to file. The EOM had a 100% FDS compliance rate on time, which I don't think has ever happened before. And we credit that with the mayor's efforts and Premier General Counsel. Also at the mayor's cabinet meeting, and this goes to show that they're still putting a priority on ethics, they had a segment devoted to ethics, specifically the Hatch Act, where the mayor's general counsel actually quizzed the room and all the agency directors on the do's and do nots of our Bega Hatch Act memo. And they did pretty well. I was impressed. Very impressed.
That's great.
So it's encouraging that they're taking ethics as seriously as they are, with respect to the cabinet meetings.
And the fact that they all were filed on time, I think is truly commendable, because it takes time and it takes work and to make sure everyone's done. And it involves, you know, disclosing stuff that people don't generally like disclosing, and it's personal information and the rest. So kudos to Mayor Bowser and her staff for getting them all on board in a timely way. And also, I do want to say again, I mentioned this before, but, you know, I get to see the email communications sometimes that occur between you, Ms. Petzel, and you, Mr. Sobin, and your staff with a number of government officials and employees about the challenges of getting these things filed on time. The patience that you show with them and your willingness to be accommodating in order to get the stuff filed, the goal being filed, because you really could just draw a line in the sand and say, it's May 16th, you're late, too bad. And you don't. And you go out of your way to try to make it workable for them and make it easy for them and be flexible in what you're requiring to the extent that you're able to do so, given, you know, what the statute says. And so I just want to say, when you say you get too many calls to count and too much. I only see a tiny little fraction of it, but you do a great, great job. And I think we've come, like, you know, this is year, we're starting year four, I guess, with us. And we're a long way from when we inherited the system that the previous owner of the FDS system had. So I do want to say thank you very, very much. I know this has been a very hard fought effort. You've worked nights and weekends, and your staff has worked so hard to do this. It is greatly appreciated because it is not in the news, because we are not on the front page of the Metro section of having failed to do this, or the mayor is not on the front page from having failed to get our staff to file. And when people call, and I get a call, you know, I get calls from the press occasionally, and they look at this stuff, and the fact that you're able to get it in and online and have people comply is no mean feat. And I just want to say on behalf of myself and the board, we really appreciate all your efforts.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Very impressive, both on the part of the executive and our own staff.
Thank you.
Okay. Anything else?
Non-confidential investigations. I actually don't have any to discuss. We have some that may be non-confidential at the end of this
right after the closed
meeting.
Right.
Unless there's something else, we can open it up for
right. So comment. Before we open this up for public comment, I do want to. I'm just going to do this for 1 minute because then I'll do it more. We're having a potluck afterwards, which is not going to be in violation of the Open Meetings Act because we won't have anything substantive to discuss. But today is our last meeting with Ms. Lathan, who has been here from the very, very beginning. Not only has she been here from the beginning, she was here before there was anything. We were sworn in on July 12th, 2012, when there was no board, there was no OGE or Office of Open, there was an Office of Open Government. It was not staffed. It was just a vacant set of FTEs. There was no office space. There were no computers. There were no pens. There were no files. There were no filing cabinets. There were no rules. There was no anything. And Ms. Lathan, myself, and Ms. Richards sat in a room, and we thought, okay. We have between July 12th and October 1 to open up the doors. How on earth is that going to happen? I want to say all this again at the luncheon, but Ms. Lathan has been a terrific partner in all of this, bringing her citizen, not insider DC government view of ethics and transparency as we've been moving along. And I just want to say publicly at the meeting part of this, thank you very much for your service. I know that it is the manner in which they may have told you that your time had come to an end may not have been the best, but I want to make sure that you know that we've appreciated everything that you've done for us, for me, for the board, and we are where we are because of what you've done. So thank you very much.
And Mr. Chairman, I'd like to, you know, we've only had the opportunity to work together a little over 5 months, and we did not know each other before I came on the board. But, Deborah, I just want you to know I have found you. I've loved your candor and your straightforwardness, and I've always found your points that you raised to be very salient. And I just want you to know that I appreciate the contributions that you have made, and I hope that we will keep a relationship we began here out of here. We always talked about having coffee, but due to our crazy schedules, we haven't done it yet, but I look forward to do it in the future. And some of the comments I just made publicly, I wrote in a little note I'm passing on to you.
Oh, thank you so very much.
So.
Well, I guess I'd like to say it's certainly been my privilege and honor to work with all of you guys. And I, you know, when Laura and Bob and I were sitting in that room, I could have never imagined that you would have grown to be, you know, a very, very impressive body. And Darren, you know, you have been an amazing steady hand and guiding light for this organization. And I really commend you on that. It's difficult to build an organization from scratch. And I've seen growth in you personally and professionally. And you've got a well-oiled team working here. And, you know, as a citizen, I'm really thrilled to say I know one part of the D.C. government that really does work.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I could go on about each and every one of you, but we have to have lunch. But, you know, Mr. Grimaldi, I thank you for your brilliance. He's an amazing writer, a great mediator. in tough times. The one case we had, I mean, you really were, you were the person who were able to get the deal done in your very, very professional, way. And Bob, I mean, we just wouldn't be here. I mean, you know, the DC government. You have the patience. I'm not a patient person. And so it's really great to have someone who has the skill, the patience, and the knowledge to really, you know, bring all of this together. And I think for me, you know, I've been blessed to have a fairly long career. Most of it was in the corporate sector. But I will say, for me, the most exhilarating part of my career has been as a public servant in the federal government and here with the district. I have had nothing more rewarding than being a public servant. And I know what it means to be a public servant and the sacrifice that each of you make because you care about the city in which you live. And so I really appreciate that. And I don't say goodbye. I just say I will see you later because I will be following you as you continue this wonderful, wonderful journey. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you very much. Okay. So at this time, we make available some time for any member of the public to comment on any of the activities of the board. I see the usual suspects in the room, so unless there's some change, I will go ahead and move or ask for a motion that we move to an executive non-public session to discuss ongoing confidential investigations pursuant to DC Code 2-575B to deliberate on a decision in which the board will exercise quasi-judicial functions pursuant to DC Code 2-575B13 and personnel matters pursuant to DC Code 2-575B10.
So moved.
Second.
Moved and seconded. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Okay, so unanimously we will move to a closed session. The time is 12:10. We'll go off the record and then back on. Okay, so we are back on the public record. The time is 12:59 still, and we have two matters to report out from the closed session. First is case number 1396-002, In re Bernard Grayson. It is a negotiated disposition. Mr. Grayson works as a contract specialist in the Office of Contracting and Procurement, and as reflected in the negotiated disposition, which will be published online later today, he misused fleet share vehicles between September 2015 until March 2016, repeatedly taking them for non-governmental purposes, including one evening where he left it running overnight so it wouldn't lock up, the details of which are contained in the negotiated disposition. In he acknowledges the code of conduct violation by misusing government property or for not using it for its authorized purposes. He's agreed to pay a $2,500 fine and attend ethics training and not engage in conduct in the future, and we worked out a payment schedule for that fine. And again, that will be posted online later today. The second matter is case number 1426-001, In re Jaron Price. Mr. Price, the Deputy Director for Business Engagement for the District Department of Employment Services, is accused in a notice of violation that was signed by the board today and will be also made public later today for violating nepotism rules where he participated in the process of hiring his sister-in-law. We will, having issued a notice of violation, the matter will be set for a hearing. Mr. Price will obviously be given an opportunity to defend against the allegation that he violated the district's nepotism rules. And in this matter, the board will now act in a judicial capacity and speak only through itself or the board's attorney, Mr. Grimaldi. And the future dates will, of course, be posted publicly as well. That is all I have for public matter. Anything else, Mr. Sobin?
That's all from the Office of Government Ethics. Thank you.
Members of the board, anything else?
Just wishing Deborah Lyson all the best, and thank you for your service.
And so with that, the time is now 1:02, and we are off to our potluck. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Oh, Mr. Chairman. Are we coming down here?
Oh, okay.
Thank you.
I think we're still recording.